As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to Danny in the Valley. Just a quick programming note before we get started today. In last week's show, I promised you two shows this week. I have to break that promise. My intended guest got sick. Tis the season. But fear not, it is Christmas after all, and I can assure you 100% that next week we will be dropping two episodes before we take a little Christmas respite. So I wanted to leave you with a little something extra before everybody disappears into full Christmas party mode and getting turkey coma and everything else. So we will be doing two shows next week, and then we're going to be taking a short holiday break for Christmas week and New Year's week. So we'll be off 2 weeks and then back, and we'll kind of keep the party going then. So do keep your eyes and ears out for those episodes next week. And the other thing, of course, give us a rating. It helps your fellow man and woman find the show. So please take a moment, click on some stars, maybe pen a few words. It's the best way for the show to keep growing and helping me find interesting folks like this week's guest.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
It's this last bastion of privacy.
Your brain.
Yeah, and yet in 50 years, I can't imagine humanity not existing as a connected set of brains. And how are we going to make those steps? Like, if we have it, we will use it. The right. AIs won't beat us because we're going to become smarter.
Hello and welcome to your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. This week, Mary Lou Jepsen is on the program. And Mary Lou is one of those people who just makes you feel bad for how little you've done with your life. So she was one of the founders of the One Laptop Per Child campaign back in the day. She was head of augmented and virtual reality at Facebook. And now she runs her own company called Open Water, which is working on a new device. Basically, the goal is to make it possible to see deep inside our bodies for 1,000th of the cost of an MRI. And ultimately, to be able to see inside our brains as well, to read our minds. Seriously, it's wild. Now, some of you may recognize her because she was featured in our other pod, Tales of Silicon Valley, in the brain episode. But we'd covered so much interesting ground that I thought it would be just a pity, a crime even, to not share the whole conversation with you, because it really is fascinating and it'll just give you a sense of where this technology is. She says it's a lot closer than we think. You can judge for yourself, but I do think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So here she is, Mary Lou Jepsen, founder of Open Water. Enjoy. What is Open Water? What are you doing? You have the floor.
Medical imaging is how we detect most diseases. The price of a scan hasn't budged in decades. My life was saved because I finally got a scan in 1995 and they found my brain tumor. I was a PhD student in physics and I was really sick. I was so sick, I dropped out of the PhD program utterly defeated to go home and die, and a med school professor sprung for the cost of an MRI.
Suddenly you were just...
Not suddenly. It took about 17 years for the tumor to develop, and I'd been sick since I was 13. I was 29 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was living in a wheelchair, sleeping 20 hours a day, body full of sores, massive, massive headaches, couldn't move half of my face. I drooled, almost as if Novocaine had been applied at the dentist. And so I could deal with that. But then I could no longer remember how to subtract, and I didn't think I deserved a PhD in physics. And right. so I just was defeated. And
you gave up.
Yeah, I gave up. I couldn't win.
Yeah.
In fact, I couldn't win. The MRI that a generous med school professor paid for uncovered my brain tumor. I was thrilled. Everybody else was mortified. I was like, great, a diagnosis. We can do something yeah. about it. 30 days later, I had my brain surgery, recovered, petitioned to get back in to my PhD program. And I'm not proud. I admit it. I use the I had a brain tumor excuse, and
everybody
it worked.
Uses that one.
I know it worked. And I finished my PhD 6 months later with two other students, got $4 million to start my first company. I've been running like hell ever since. But it always stuck with me that I would have died without access to that.
Because an MRI costs what?
It depends which country.
Yeah.
But, you know, around $1,000. It's depends if it's subsidized and so forth. In the U.S., it's an 80% gross margin business. It's the profit center for hospitals. So
80%?
It generates $50 billion of revenue a year. So we're actually making a decision on, for example, breast cancer. We know MRIs better for detecting breast cancer for half of the women that have dense breast tissue. So they're only detected at stage 3 and beyond with mammography. We could choose to give them MRI scans, but we don't because we want the 80% gross margin. So it's a actuarial decision to let women find out they have breast cancer late. But let's just, you know, right. change up the whole right. thing. So what am I doing in open water? Lowering the cost of medical imaging to see inside of our bodies by 1,000-fold at scale and putting it into a portable with no x-rays, no gamma rays like mammography has or CT yeah. scan, using components that we can make, that we're making right now in the trillion-dollar consumer electronics supply chain. Not existing components. I'm a chip designer.
Yeah.
So we've designed new camera chips, new ultrasonic chips, and a new kind of laser that lets us see deep inside of the body with resolution. Right now, some of our scans are exceeding the resolution and perhaps more importantly, the image quality of existing multi-million dollar MRI systems, the system that saved my life.
And this would be instead of like a giant, people know what an MRI looks like.
Yeah, it's
like
a big 2-ton magnet with a hole in the middle, and that's where you lie and you lay on this tray and they slide it inside. A lot of people are claustrophobic and don't like it. Children have a tough time staying still, and people that are obese can't fit inside of it, so they get CT scans. CT scans are responsible for, depending upon the study, between 3 and 12% of the cancers. The medical imaging system itself causes the cancer because of the radiation that you're right. exposed to.
So when you talk about turning that giant machine into a portable, what does that portable look like?
It's interesting. I design hardware,
yeah.
and so, but I don't style the plastic housing and figure out the ID and the UX. The hard yeah. part of putting a room-sized piece of equipment into a portable or a wearable is actually the technology. So we haven't hired our designer yet to style it.
You don't have your Johnny Ive yet.
Right. And and I've worked with some of the best designers in the world, and it's too early. But it could be a ski hat. It could be basically almost like a bandage, or it could be more like something the size of a smartphone where you scan over your body like almost like a wand. Right now, what we're working on is a desktop system that allows us to make changes. And so it has a tethered wand and,
right.
and a slightly larger optical playout, but you know, it could fit in ambulances and things
yeah.
like that. Like right now, there's $10 million cost ambulances with CT scanners in them. There's maybe 100 of them in the world because the leading cause of disability in developed world countries is not getting a scan fast enough after a stroke, because there's basically two kinds of stroke, a clot type stroke which blocks blood flow, or a hemorrhagic type stroke,
burst.
Bursts.
Yeah.
And so you can burst the clot or clot the burst with a drug. But if you get the drug wrong, the patient dies. And today that means access to a CT scanner
right.
as soon as possible after stroke. And so people that live in cities can walk and talk after strokes. People that don't can't.
Dead.
I never had a conversation with my grandfather because he had a massive stroke prior to my birth.
Where are you in terms of the technology? Is it, I mean, have you done it, so to speak? And now it's a question of kind of bringing it all together and productizing it, or where are you in that journey?
The company's about 2 years old. We now are scanning live animals, rats, at a secret undisclosed location in South San Francisco to make sure that we can scan. We're using infrared light and sonic pings and finding the tumor in the rat, or buying whatever's on sale at the Safeway a couple blocks from here, and Kobe beef, and scanning that and seeing how well we can do, or scanning phantoms in our systems so we can optimize the...
You're actually like buying some, I don't know, some chicken breasts?
Yeah.
From the...
Kidneys, pork.
Right.
Whatever's on sale,
right,
actually.
Right.
We're literally a block from a Safeway.
Yeah.
So whatever's on sale, to test our system, to see how well we can do. We also create phantoms. And in fact, we're even starting to work with a company that's growing organs and saying, great, grow us in organs, because we just need canonical. So yeah, we're in animals this year, humans, we think, next year. When you're making a medical imaging system, you've got to go through FDA, you've got to go through clinical trials. What our first products are, we're still determining, but R&D doesn't require FDA. So, you know, there's lots of areas where this can be useful as soon as next year in terms of early product at small scale as we prove ourselves. So that's like maybe veterinary, maybe it's, you know, helping drug companies develop drugs more quickly, because part of it is this cost structure of knowing if it works. I mean, ultimately, you don't have to die of things if you can catch them early.
I've talked to some companies who talk about how they can detect stage zero cancer using machine learning, you know, just like they can find the needle in the haystack before the human can.
Right.
And if you do that, then it's not like you're taking a Tylenol and everything's fine, but it's just much easier.
So we have that with blood tests. There's some genetic stuff that we're starting to make sense of, but that seems like a long road, but, you know, it's been a while, so hopefully, and the cost has gone down a lot. But medical imaging hasn't. And so why, if we can see inside of our bodies, stage zero, like we all have cancers all the time, but our immune systems are able to kill them. So what you want to do is watch. You actually, if you could do a scan every day or every week, you'd care about three things. Is it getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Is it staying the same size? You probably only act in case one. If you're in cancer treatment, you'd be interested if it was getting smaller. Our technology also can allow us to deliver, for example, chemotherapy drugs or other drugs to local parts of the body without it streaming and bathing through the rest of your body. So in a chemotherapy situation, maybe you don't have to, you know, lose your hair or
not a problem for me.
Or go through the pain of the extreme pain of lose a year of work as well. But, you know, like Angela Jolie literally cut off part of her body because she had the BRCA gene. We could someday make a bra that people with the BRCA gene could wear and find out if there was an issue and get it treated
because
early.
It can non-invasively just scan.
Yes, with just near-infrared light and sonic pings.
So can we talk about, so how does it work?
How does it work? So there's three basic keys to how it works.
Okay.
One is that our body is translucent to near-infrared light. You know this if you've ever been outside in a dark night and cupped your hand over a flashlight.
It turns red.
Red light goes through, right.
Right.
And near-infrared light goes through even better, but you can't see it.
But
it's benign near-infrared light, less than we're exposed to on a sunny day. The problem is that light scatters. People have used near-infrared light for medical imaging systems for like 100 years. Everybody thinks scattering is random. Here's where my physics PhD comes in.
Yeah.
It's not. Not if you can record the phase of the light. And the phase of the light is like if you imagine an ocean wave, is it the peak or the trough or somewhere in between? That's all phase means. The phases of the moon, you know, like is it full? Is it? It's just an arc. And so you can do that if the pixel size of the camera chip we record on is the size of the wavelength of light. That's been true for the past 5 years for all of humanity that has a smartphone. The pixel size is the size of the wavelength of light. So we can record the phase. It's possible if we just pull off the color filters that record the camera pictures that you take with your smartphones. There's usually a little piece of jello that's either red and lets it red through a green or blue, and red, green, and blue makes so-called color. You pull them off and you record and you optimize the camera chip to give very high transfer of infrared light. They call it quantum efficiency. But basically, for all the infrared photons that come in, you get a high signal. And so that means you make the layer of silicon a little bit thicker. That's all happened. In fact, most smartphones are doing something called 3D sensing to sense if it's your face, not a picture of you, or ultimately to enable
Face ID, basically.
Yeah, Face ID. But really, all the money was put in place for next generation virtual reality and augmented reality. And the big money maker so far there has been Pokemon Go. So basically, we have this technology because Pokemon Go did so well. And so this is funny. For Pokemon Go plus plus.
Well, it's funny. A lot of the people we have, I feel like a lot of people I have on this podcast talk about what the smartphone has done for their businesses that ostensibly have nothing to do with smartphones.
Yeah.
But it's just this whole miniaturization of everything
and
this whole huge supply chain. Like, we can make all of this really highly specialized, very powerful stuff really cheaply.
Right. So millions of these kinds of camera chips are shipping every single day.
Right.
For about a year now. But a couple years ago, I knew that was coming down the pike because I was in charge of advanced development of VR and AR at Oculus and Facebook.
Right.
And I thought, whoa, maybe we could do something so much bigger than VR and AR. We could transform medical imaging and change the way we both read and write our bodies and brains. And so I left it to found this company. I've founded other companies. It's not a new thing for me. I like startups. But so we record the phase of the light and we scan out the body by focusing these ultrasonic pings that we can now make ultrasonic chips in silicon factories. We focus down the ping. The light is scattering everywhere through your body. The light that goes through that focused ping of ultrasound changes color.
Gotcha.
Changes
color. So you have one chip shooting light into the body.
Or just a fiber. It could just be a fiber brought in,
right,
snaking through, and just scatters everywhere.
Okay.
And then we take a chip, we focus the ultrasonic sound down, and the light that goes through that focus changes color. Just like the pitch of a police car siren changes as it speeds past you.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
the Doppler
shift. Doppler shift.
Yeah.
And so we use that. And we also then color change what's called a reference beam, so we can beat or interfere or make a hologram of the light that went through that ultrasonic ping and filter out everything else, because that creates these ripples. It creates these, they call them fringes, interference, and the other light that doesn't get shifted in color doesn't. It's sort of like we're looking for a ripple on a sea of unshifted light, and we decode that on the camera chip. It ends up looking like, if you remember this iconic picture of X-ray diffraction from the first picture of DNA that Rosalind Franklin made, she decoded that structure to reveal the actual double helix for the first time. She didn't get credit for it, but now she has.
Yeah.
She's dead. And so what we do is decode that structure on the camera chip, but much faster than it took her. So we can do that. The technical term, it's basically a Fourier transform, but math. We just do math on it and decode it and get information about that. And then we move the sonic ping to the next spot and the next spot and the next spot, and we scan out
and it's instantaneous.
The body. Oh, yeah. We can do up to a million times a second, maybe even faster.
So
right now we're going slower, though.
Right, right. So basically you're using infrared light and sonic pings to render on a very, very, very detailed level what's happening inside the body,
tissues. Yeah, we're scanning at about a half a millimeter resolution right now. I showed live on stage at TED going down to a micron. MRI is about a millimeter to 4 millimeters, so we're better in terms of resolution. We're really focused on image quality. So when you're seeing images inside of your body, it's all, they call it a signal to noise game.
Right.
So you want less noise, more signal. Last month, we exceeded the image quality of MRI for certain scans.
Right.
So we're working very hard on where we go first based on the image quality we're getting for various organs.
So basically, it's a better MRI, miniaturized. It's kind of like the iPhone of MRI.
Maybe. Although I'd say, your iPhone is pretty darn expensive.
It is. I know.
So I started a project in 2005 called, it was actually called the $100 Laptop Corporation.
I do want to talk about this. I think this is fascinating.
We lowered the cost by 10x. We're talking about lowering the cost by 1,000-fold and the size by 1,000,000-fold. And that's, you know, that's like, sorry, but bigger than an iPhone. I mean, I had smartphones way before the iPhone came out. It was a nice instantiation of the iPhone with a lot of functionality that didn't exist before. But, you know, we did have like laptops that did that.
Yeah,
it was smaller and stuff. But it made a lot of money. And so it changed many people's lives, especially with the software application. But the hardware, I'm not trying to diss it, but touchscreens was around for a long time.
And the next step beyond medical imaging, I've seen you talk about this kind of brain-computer interface.
Sure.
Or kind of telepathy.
So that's existed for the past decade, basically courtesy of graduate students in neuroscience trying to get their PhDs. So if I throw you in an MRI scanner for an hour, I can tell you got a tumor, or a clogged heart, or you know things like that, which we can act on. If I do it for 10 to 100 hours, recording your mind reacting to podcasts like this or YouTube videos, I can then predict what words you're about to say, what images are in your head.
You can predict what I'm going to say.
We can more than predict, infer it, I think, using basically a data store of your mind's use of oxygen, which is what fMRI does, which is the basically video version of MRI. You use the same machine for fMRI.
Right.
So if I just if you lay in there for 100 hours
and, you
and listen
video
to your podcasts, all of them.
Which would be, your mind would just be alight.
That's right. So much. And then the computer would make a dictionary, if you will, of or an atlas of how your mind reacts to different words.
A data set.
And then, using the tools of our time,
algorithms,
neural net with back propagation, when you start to think of new words, the computer can guess what words they are, or word clouds, as has been shown now for a decade, just across the bay by Jack Gallant's lab at UC Berkeley and many other places. There's a Japanese group that threw graduate students in the MRI scanners and let them fall asleep and then woke them up every couple of minutes and say, what was your dream about? Wrote it down, made the correlation of the pattern. You can dump your dreams to your computer. The grainy versions, it's kind of uncomfortable to lay in an MRI scanner. I don't know if anyone's been in them. It sounds like a machine gun going off. Yeah, it's noisy and sort of uncomfortable. I also nap in them because I have to do them every year.
Yeah.
We can talk about my radicalization by being a participant in the U.S. healthcare system. But it's ridiculous. I have to prove every year that I still am missing the part of my brain, even though there's actually not a single recorded.
Is that really true?
It's really true. I'm a cash cow of the U.S. healthcare industry.
Incredible.
We're called chronics. We're 5% of the population.
You have to show that part of your brain that was removed hasn't magically grown back?
Every year.
Okay.
Or the chemicals that part of my brain used to make but no longer make that I need every day to live are withheld.
How depressing.
It's why I became an entrepreneur, though, because I was going to be a multimedia artist, but then I, you know.
Oh, really?
I was doing physics, and I was designed a system to project video on the moon, and oh my God, I had like MTV and all these sponsors for it, and I was
doing
that. You
were going to project video onto the moon?
Yeah, I designed a system. And then, you know, I got the brain tumor, and I came out, and I'm like, you know, I really need health insurance. I better, like, get serious and go get a real job, and, you know, like, you have to. Because it's the U.S.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I know. I've lived in the U.K. for a long time, so I know very well the differences.
Yeah, and most other countries too.
Yeah.
But the fact is, 3/4 of humanity lacks access to medical imaging. But back to telepathy. You know, like, you could say, stop the telepathy. There's profound legal and ethical and moral issues with it. Say we do shrink this to a ski hat.
Yeah.
Profound what that can do for brain disease, which is the most expensive healthcare for every country on the planet, if you combine neurodegenerative disease with mental disease. But you could say, nope, we don't want to use this on our brain. We are committed at Open Water to our systems only working with consensual use from adults. But, you know, 4 questions. We make the ski hat, that replaces the functionality of fMRI, but not just grainy images, but we increase the resolution, the data store, the hierarchical understanding of the brain.
Creating that data set from your brain.
Yeah, because you could wear it for, you know,
upload it to the cloud.
1,000 hours.
Yeah.
Well, you can keep it on a, you know, hard disk in your office if you don't want to have it in the cloud. But there's a lot of issues right now with privacy from social media. And so
it's the new thing.
This ups it by 100x because, you know, it's this last bastion of privacy.
Your brain.
Yeah. And yet, in 50 years, I can't imagine humanity not existing as a connected set of brains. And how are we going to make those steps? Like, if we have it, we will use it. AIs won't beat us because we're going to become smarter. I mean, 100 billion neurons, each with 100,000 different connections. It's a pretty complex tool for creativity. And we have, each of us are different, and how do we communicate together? Right now, we're all like Stephen Hawking. Like, literally, we have talking sticks. I talk, then you talk.
Yes,
and, like,
yes,
there's just this stream of words that come out.
Mm-hmm.
Babies, you just told me you have a baby.
Yep.
They don't think in words. What? They think in images and audio. What if we could dump everything going on in our brain out? Like, what if we had, instead of this talking stick, what if we had a shared little whiteboard where I showed the images and words I was thinking, you, yours, and maybe your audience, if they were live, could participate,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd realize, wow, that person's thinking, let's talk about that instead. This is boring what we're talking about.
Yeah,
like, what if that could happen in a meeting room, like any meeting? I was just in an all-hands meeting, 20 people. I'm the boss, so I'm talking, but, you know, I might have not have had the most interesting. Maybe somebody had a bone to pick with me, but was being polite and, you know, just be really great. We turned filters on, so it wouldn't be like what I had for breakfast. Oh, I'm hungry. When am I going to go to whatever, go get the errand done? Like, we could just filter those things out and just see the part that was relevant to work. But
this is just like, you could go on for hours about all the implications here, because even just the idea of filters, because obviously people are thinking all kinds of stuff.
It's called creativity, though, right? Because
it's
how things bounce together in your mind.
And so this idea is, you know, Elon Musk is the kind of the probably the most well-known AI doomsdayer in terms of saying it's summoning the demon and all of this stuff. But he's also working on things like Neuralink, where he's said publicly, but nothing's happened yet. I don't really know what's happening there. But, you know, basically, we're not that far from every human having superhuman capability or just being plugged in directly to AI. And I don't really know how that works, but that seems to be what he is talking about.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's similar to what...
It's interesting because I go to a lot of these neuroscience conferences.
Yeah.
Like, we're the only ones doing brain and body because they're made out of muscle and fat and blood and bone. And we can't distinguish between body and brain. And there's this huge unmet need in healthcare. But we can also get the brain with our system. But I go to these conferences on the brain-computer communication, more than interface, but brain-computer communication, and everybody else is doing implants. In a world where cardiovascular disease with solids in our bloodstream is the number one cause of death, I suggest it's going to take some time. And it's not going to hit a billion people in 10 years because there's some major issues. But I'm the only one of them that has had brain surgery. Hardest thing I did in my entire life, by far. I just don't see people doing elective brain surgery in the next decade. In a few decades, maybe. But in the next decade, you know, if I've got full-blown Parkinson's, and can bring it on, you know, whatever. Alzheimer's, right, great, do it. But I don't see it happening for us to augment ourselves and make ourselves better in the near term. So certainly where we can make some meaningful progress. But, you know, look, mental disease. There's a study released about a year ago in the U.S. fMRIs of people with clinical depression were pulled together from, I think, 5 hospitals showing that you can tell from the fMRI what kind of depression the person has and if it's getting better or worse in a precision way. Because right now, what we have is DSM. You literally answer these questions to see if you've got depression. One of the questions are you sleeping all the time?
Do you have thoughts
Do you have thoughts of suicide? Have you gained weight? You know, and if you answer yes to those, you're clinically depressed. And the way that you find out if you're getting better is you start answering no to them based on the therapy. But what if we could actually move that? I mean, it's a huge, huge thing, just clinical depression. Could we move that with scans that would enable us to see the progression, diagnose more precisely what kind of depression the person has, and if the therapy is working or not? Is it getting better, worse, or staying the same?
Right, and you can diagnose that by basically monitoring what is happening in the actual brain itself.
With an fMRI, you could do it right now. The going price for those in San Francisco where we're sitting is $18,000 a shot. I mean, an MRI here is $12,000. You can't afford to do that every week or every month to monitor somebody that's clinically depressed. We decide it's too expensive. Although it's very interesting, I was at a big conference in Vancouver called TED a few weeks ago, and even billionaires are cost conscious. There was a facility there where you could get a full body MRI scan for $2,000.
Oh, so like
and lots
cut price.
Of them were doing them. You know, 1 millimeter resolution in the head, 4 millimeter in the body.
Yeah.
And as much as people are saying, oh, medical imaging is used too much, if you're a billionaire, you want to know if you've got stage one or stage two.
For
and
sure.
I think everybody's going to want what the billionaires have. We want to find out how disease works. We want to find out how our minds work. We could say we don't want to know how our minds work.
It doesn't feel like that's the direction of travel, though.
We can make laws against it. China isn't, right? China right now has 1 million construction workers wearing hard hats with EEGs in them. And those workers have been told their thoughts are being read. It's not actually true. EEG isn't that well good. Ostensibly, they want that so the construction worker is focused on their job. But the construction worker just thinks they have to think good thoughts. So China has said what they intend to do, if you extrapolate, with brain-computer communication already.
Dystopia realized.
Or are they say they're protecting their population from the social media kind of, you know, garbage heap.
Right.
By making sure they only get safe content.
But
they
so,
have a point.
Oh, absolutely. But you do think that this, the eventuality of, if we were sitting here 20 years from now, you and I, potentially wouldn't even have to speak, but we could still communicate.
Yes. Would we use language? You know, you're probably a words guy. I'm an engineer. I did art. You know, I think in images.
Right.
My typical day-to-day or week-to-week is working with engineers who do not speak English as a first language and on whiteboards all around the world trying to figure out how to solve physics and engineering problems. And so what we do is diagrams and equations on whiteboards. It takes a long time to debug because somebody's like, no, you're wrong. And if I can just get an engineer on the whiteboard, I'm halfway there.
Yeah.
But then I just wish I could just go and dump the image that I see, the full image, and then they could say, no. I'm like, oh, okay, what about? And or somebody else. And they're just so much faster, so much more efficient to be able to figure out, because it's very hard to put like the engineering physics concepts into words that everybody can understand, because those words have like this precision. Like we have words like
it's a bit of
polarization that means something in optics, or coherence, which means a very specific thing in about lasers. And
it can be an impediment.
Like, I know what coherence is. They stick together. And like, that's true too. But like, you know, like we like they're it's just imprecise. And it's better if they could just see the image in my head. And could you imagine creative people, like, think, you know, down in L.A., like, being able to dump, you know, a movie director wakes up and has had a dream. And
this is my vision.
Yeah. Can we change what we're going to shoot today? Here's a rough cut. Ignore the girl in the nightgown. That's me. You know, like, whatever. Like, whatever you have to edit out. Just for the close team, like, just ignore that. You know, you forget about that. You're all NDA. Yeah. You know, like, whatever else was in the dream you don't want to admit to. We might have to actually deal with what we actually think and understand it. But why wouldn't we? Because we don't want to be that. But maybe we have to define what we are. I mean,
well, that's what's so interesting now. Like right now, Facebook and Google, that all of a sudden it's like they're in this huge arms race to show how private they are, how respectful of privacy they are, which is kind of a complete reaction of what's been happening the past decade, let's call it.
So especially since 2016.
Exactly.
You know, Brexit. And
exactly.
We got a new president, which we were all surprised about here in San Francisco.
Indeed.
As As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And so, but it does feel like that is a, there's a kind of this pivot toward privacy. Who knows how long that'll last, what direction it'll go, but it does feel like it's kind of a bit of a reckoning. The world that you're talking about is like that times, I don't know what the...
I'm saying it's inevitable. It's absolutely inevitable. Because if we can see inside of our bodies, and that muscle and fat and blood and bone, we can see inside of our brains. We can make laws against seeing inside of our brains if we want to. We can only see inside of our brains for certain cases, like brain disease. But, you know, the flip side is you've got the national academies of most every developed country on the planet saying of the top five things you can do as a technologist, understanding how the brain works is on that list, somewhere between one and five. So there's a lot of effort being poured into it. European Brain Initiative, the White House Brain Initiative, there's all of this work going on.
It's kind of like the final frontier.
Do we want to understand how the brain works or not? We could say, nope. Bury head in sand. How long will that last? Can you imagine the curiosity of humans? Not.
No.
It might take longer, but given with existing multi-million dollar fMRIs, we're getting grainy images. And with the hierarchical understanding that's being developed, because right now it's just looking at fMRI looks at oxygen use millimeter by millimeter in your brain.
And I've seen that video that you've used.
Yeah.
And it's grainy, but it's also kind of unbelievable that this is just based on oxygen happening in your brain.
Right.
And then you see the video that the person is watching on the left, and then you see what the fMRI is producing, and it's the same. It's just the right is more grainy, and you're like, what?
And when you imagine an image versus seeing an image, the same areas of brain use oxygen.
Right.
And so that means you could literally dump grainy versions of images in your head today. If we up the resolution and the data store and add into that, you know, like I showed live on stage that we could read the state of a neuron, not just the oxygen use. What about adding in these different modalities? Where are we going to get to? I think it's going to come a lot faster. I think a lot of people think, yeah, that's grainy now. I think what's going to happen is maybe the first products will be grainy. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, it's going to hit people, whoa, these are really good. What about the data store? What about the privacy? So it's really great that we're having this discussion about social media right now as the brain-computer interfaces are coming to market in a few years, because it's baked in to everybody's thoughts on what we do about, you know, those four questions I ask. Like, can the police make you put this on? Can the military make you wear this thing? Can your spouse make you wear it? Can you put it on the head of your teenage kid when they come home at 3 a.m. and you want to know what they were doing and where they've been? And I think the answer is...
Because you could see their thoughts.
Yeah. I think the answer is no to all of those questions.
Yeah.
But it's not
but they're questions
my decision.
That will, right. And there's questions...
We will make it only work consensually for all users. Like the user has to wish to share the thoughts.
But those are questions that will have to be answered at some point.
I mean, when I first saw this work, the work you were just talking about with the grainy images with the MRI scanner from the UC Berkeley system, the next thought I had is, oh my gosh, this is happening in Guantanamo Bay with the so-called terrorist prisoners that don't have rights after the 9/11 bill. I don't know if that's true. I just know the Defense Department has poured a lot of money into brain-computer communications. I don't know why. When I talk to them, and I have talked to them, they say, you know, a commander total important thing in a theater of war is if the commanding officer knows the command was understood and received by the soldier that gets it. Right. I can see that being super important.
So you don't have that bad game of telephone.
And the other thing is I've met with generals who their number one issue is that a couple dozen veterans are committing suicide every single day. It's brain disease. They want to solve that. It just kills them. So, you know, it doesn't have to be this nefarious, like, how is it being used to extract people's thoughts that are suspected terrorists? It could also help on those fronts as well.
And I guess my other question is, how would you and I share those? In other words, would I have to have a screen next to me that you could see? In other words, if we're sitting here and we don't need to speak and I can kind of, as you say, kind of dump my thought out, where would that be?
I think it might be like these shared whiteboard tables, but eventually, read, write, which means, you know, what happens to education? You put a little brain hat on and Shakespeare is dumped in and you get to carry that with you, right? Yeah. Eventually, that has the such profound, I mean, one is sort of privacy, the first and the read. If we're talking about writing thoughts, that's free will. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually decided to hold off on that and not enable it in our systems.
We're the
only brain computer communication company that we're also doing medical imaging, and we're going to do the medical imaging first, but the same thing can be used for any part of your body, which is why we talk about it. We're really focused on the medical imaging right now, but we're the only ones that talk about it openly.
Why do you think that is?
I can tell you why I talk, why the others don't.
Why do you talk?
It kills me how much great work I've done at large corporations in the world that I couldn't talk about that will never see the light of day. Because even though they were killed for various reasons, it tended not to have anything to do with the technology. Most tech projects don't fail because the technology is bad, and I would like to see the technology live on. The other side of it is the most successful project I've ever been involved in. I've co-founded with my much more famous co-founder, Nicholas Negroponte. And he'd go out and just talk about doing this crazy thing to get a laptop to every child in the world. And we made it work, basically.
The $100 laptop.
The $100 laptop. Yeah, I was designed the $100 laptop, brought it to mass production, and Nicholas was the CEO and co-founder, and oh my God, he had an incredible Rolodex, and he used he did it right before. I would think it was pretty much his last full-time job. He's now semi-retired in his mid-70s, but, you know, doing just amazing. Every time I see him, he's just doing all this. He's not retired at all. he just tells people that.
Yeah.
It was amazing. He figured out the business model. Like, how do you do it? You work with heads of states and ministers of education to distribute to the laptops to children because we could make them cheaper than textbooks over 5 years at that time. Now we can make tablets for $20 a piece, which is just a no-brainer. And how did we get that done? We went out and talked to everybody about it. They thought we were stark raving mad, but we kept talking because you get the criticism. You design in the open. It means you create competition, but who cares? Like, compete to save the world. Great, let's go. And so I started Open Water with that. I mean, there's open in the name to sort of, let's just get this done. You know, VR and AR it's a slow slog. It's great that these manufacturing processes exist because of some pushes there. But the cost of an MRI scan hasn't budged since it saved my life in 1995. It's gone up, actually, because the profit margins and the business models and so forth.
Of course.
Three quarters of humanity lacks access to it. Let's get it done. So I talk about it. And how do you solve the ethical issues that we're talking about, given that our brains and bodies are made of the same basic ingredients, without admitting there's a problem? Step one, right, on the 10-step problem. What is the solution? first, people have to then believe. So you talk about it. People think you're stark raving. We're showing the stuff. The physics are solid. The engineering is solid. We'll start to show our latest images of rats. And people are like, great, that's rats. Show us with humans. What's the ID look like? What's the form factor? Like, all of these questions we'll expose. But we, you know, expose answers to as we walk through it. But I think every month since I started the company, I've given a public talk about where we are. And the reason...
Just being like, hey, this is happening, this is progressing.
Here's where we were 2.5 years ago, here's where we are. Because, A, you get the crazy people of the world to beat a path to your door, and I mean crazy in a good way. Like, we're alive, right? I take a dozen medications a day. If I don't get one of them, I die. So, you know, I look down that bottle of pills and like, what do you want to do when you're alive? You know, so this seems like a pretty good mission. And then, oh my gosh, management is so easy because most engineers, you know, like literally at some companies, like PhDs in electrical engineering, literally their job is to move the connector 3.73 millimeters to realize the new design idiom of the smartphone. And maybe it might be fun for your first job out of getting your PhD, but you know, that's probably not why you slogged it out.
Yeah.
And so what can we do with our talent to transform humanity and in a positive way? And yet there's some implications here that are pretty profound and could have profound potential for misuse.
Yeah.
And so we try to have a public conversation about it and progress. And I've met with tons and tons of ethicists and groups working on this. Each one of them wants to be the person, the group in charge of the ethics.
I'm like,
actually, and they all tend to be in London, Boston, or San Francisco. And actually, I don't think those three cities are going to dictate the future of brains. But
yeah,
you know, they certainly want to. You know, we need other parts.
And are you, in terms of what you're doing, there are others.
Yeah, they're billionaires' pet projects.
Yeah.
We're a venture-backed startup. It's gotten close to $30 million in finance. So we're like the only one that's not a university research group.
Right.
Or a single billionaire funding it on a long-term effort. And that's because we're not just doing brain, but body.
Body, right.
And I wish they'd talk more about it, but... How do we make them feel comfortable talking about it?
Yeah. Well, Elon Musk in particular, I mean, he's hasn't helped by just beating this drum of AI's the end of humanity. And kind of, he says that with some regularity, at least an existential threat to humanity. That's how he...
Vince, why is he doing driverless cars?
Oh, I know.
There seems to be
a great irony there, isn't it?
They require AI.
Exactly.
So that seems...
Yeah, bit controversial.
Elon's amazing, so you know he's he should probably just take a moment and think about his logic structure. But you know, I'm not the one to give advice to Elon Musk. He's doing fine. Yeah. Clearly, he has a. If he'd just explain it to all of us, we'd love to hear it.
And then, just on the one laptop per child project, are there any things that you did there or saw there that are analogous to what you're trying to do here?
Rather than 10x. Ultimately, 1,000x. Although our first products our first products will not be 1,000x. Yeah. It takes scale for that, and because of clinical trials, FDA safety, it will take
longer.
Single digit numbers of years. Yeah. I hope that single digit is smaller rather than larger. But yes, less than 10 years. We can get there, leveraging the consumer electronics existing supply chain and the regulation to hit scale. It may not be in the U.S. The United States is absolutely not the healthcare system that's not the most open to innovation in the world for all kinds of reasons.
You would think, given that it is thoroughly capitalist, that it would be. Given that the other systems are socialist or, you know, kind of...
Well, hospitals, they're making 80% gross margin on MRI scanners. I've had heads of hospitals in suburban areas saying their hospital will go out of business if open water succeeds. Because the only way they make profit is on the medical imaging scans. That's why they're so expensive. I suggest to them they're doing their accounting wrong. Eric Topol just wrote this fantastic book. If you don't know what he is, follow him on Twitter. He wrote this fantastic book very famous cardiologist, used to be at Cleveland Clinic, mm-hmm. now is, I don't know, in San Diego or something. T-O-P-O-L is his name. And he says, look, he's advocating for more doctor-patient time. He thinks medical imaging is overused. Mm-hmm. It's why healthcare is so expensive. Actually, it's profit margins. But so he then, his own data, because he's a really good footnoter, half of the book is footnotes.
Yeah.
Very well documented. And the first 3 minutes of a doctor meeting with a patient, if they can diagnose what the patient has by looking at them, they are correct 90% of the time.
Interesting.
If it takes longer than 3 minutes, they're correct 25% of the time. If it requires a second opinion, the second opinion correlates with the first opinion, doctor one to doctor two, 12% of the time. The way we can make a decision, sure, like if you are, you know, spitting up blood and with, you know, green hair, whatever, like, yes, it's this. But, you know, the reality is I suffered, so many people suffer because symptoms are vague. If you've got these five symptoms, 80% of the time it's one of these three or four things. And if it's not, it's one of a million things. They don't know.
Yeah.
So people suffer. And the second opinion doesn't correlate with the first opinion because we don't have data. So why does the doctor looking or talking to the patient longer uncover that? Why are we opposed to data? We do with blood tests. And if we could say overuse of looking inside of the body, let's just get rid of that blood pressure cuff because it might have false positives. And let's just forget taking your temperature as well.
Right.
And, you know, I have a smartwatch. Let's just get rid of knowing my heartbeat. Like, really, the reason they're doing that is because of the cost structure. And the cost structure is one imposed by the hospitals and the three companies that basically have a monopoly. They pulled all the patents together to make MRI machines. I mean, it's an amazing technology. It saved my life.
Yeah.
But the prices are the same as in 1995.
Yeah.
It's 25 years. People are dying. Why don't we leapfrog the technology with the tools of our time? We want to see inside of our bodies to understand disease progression so people don't have to die of what they get. They can we can catch everything early if we combine that with genetics, blood, and better medical imaging.
Yeah.
That's cheaper. And then what that does is slash the need for brick-and-mortar hospitals.
Right.
So, yeah, we're talking about taking out the hospitals. So why do it in a place like San Francisco? There's great hospitals. There's rich people. You know, what does an engineer make here? Fine for the engineers. The non-engineers, huge problem, right?
Yeah.
So instead, why don't we take a place that doesn't have hospitals or really needs them? You know, there's a lot of places in the world. So it seems a lot like it's like the global middle class. I talked to the head of a Latin American country group of hospitals, and he told me the death rate due to cancer in that country is three times that of the United States. And he believes, the head of this whole hospital group for a country, believes it's for one reason, that medical imaging is too expensive.
Right.
And so the future belongs to those who want it.
And as part of that bargain, we may, oh, it sounds like we will get the kind of the hive mind.
Yeah, we want individual. I mean, will it be a hive? Yeah, well, connect. Is that a hive mind?
I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Because isn't that there's the queen bee and the drones and sort of taking that? We're all creative in different ways. I wonder if language goes away ultimately. There's this great beauty to language.
Mm.
You know, there's also sitting down and writing or sitting down and drawing or sitting down and making music lets you fine-tune your thoughts with this feedback of how
but
it looks.
But maybe talking will become like the horse and carriage.
Because we can communicate at light speed, like the whole thought, before you get interrupted.
Exactly.
Because it really is single track right now.
Right. So speaking will be old school.
I do believe most people think this is really far away, and I think it's a single-digit number of years away. And I think no one will believe me for a while. But as you keep, no one will be, certain people do believe me and come and join the effort, which is one of the reasons I talk about it. But I also think there's this ethical requirement to talk about it, to figure out what the right thing to do is.
Yeah, because this is, I mean, this is bigger than, obviously bigger than the telephone, bigger than the computer, bigger than the car. This is, it's kind of gets to the nature of humanity.
I, yeah, well, maybe. I mean, I think it's pretty big when we're able to do it. But a neuroscientist will tell you, we don't even know what a thought is. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. Okay, I believe you, right? We don't know how. Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, who died last fall, used to tell me, like, look, there's 5 Nobel Prizes just to understand how a neuron works, and you think you're going to enable brain-computer interfaces, ignoring it. Paul Allen put his money where his mouth is, founded the Allen Institute for the Brain. They do fabulous work, go to their website, they open source most of it, they talk about what they do. They're trying to go bottoms up, and we're going top down. And I think we can meet them in the middle. There's a lot of people working on a lot of different approaches to this, and it's pretty hard to imagine they're not going to mix and match and explode beyond those grainy images we see with fMRI to something much better more quickly. Now, a good friend of mine sent me this paper last summer about people using typical neuroscience approaches to figure out how a computer chip worked. And that computer chip was loaded in with software to drive the video game Donkey Kong.
Yep.
Classic. And so they zapped, classic game, right? They zapped a transistor at a time, and guess what? They couldn't figure out how Donkey Kong worked. And they said, you know, the way neuroscience is working doesn't even allow us to decode how a much less complex chip works. So it's way too hard.
Right.
And like, great. Because they had no hierarchical understanding of what did what on the chip. We have some hierarchical understanding of how the brain works. We know where the speech center is. We know where the motor center is. We know where different. We know where the processing of visual information is in the back, and we know, you know, different things. And we're learning more about that. And so, as we apply that hierarchy to understanding the neurons, we can get further. But with existing fMRI for 10 years. In universities all around the world, we've been able to decode grainy versions of images, words, music, dreams, whether they're in love or not, and so forth, for a decade. And so making that to be something you can wear for thousands of hours, with the breakthroughs in machine learning and AI and deep learning with back propagation, it's pretty hard to take the side of more data with better AI tools is going to give us worse images.
Yeah.
No, much better with higher resolution, which our systems enable.
Yeah.
And then combining that with the enormous work being done on this globally.
The train's leaving the station.
And, you know, someone will get those Nobel Prizes for figuring out how the neuron works, I'm sure. But
maybe you'll be my first Nobel Prize winner on the podcast.
No, we're not working on the neuron. No, that'll be somebody else. We're doing the math. We're not in that thing. But Paul Allen's, you know, the Allen Institute, or whoever's working on how the neuron works. Totally important thing. How do neurons work? Most people can use computers. They don't know how. I happen to know how they work. I've designed them. Yeah. But most people just use them. There could be little green men inside of the computer.
Totally.
You use it, it reacts, it works. It as important as it is to understand how it works, without understanding how it works, with just looking at oxygen use, we already can infer so much. So if we get more data at higher resolution, with more hierarchical differentiation and understanding of the brain from all the people working on it, we will get better images and words. And this could be profoundly helpful for people that weren't within 2 hours of a CT scanner when they had a stroke, like my grandfather, because it was before CT scanners existed. Yeah. They can't speak. People have lock-in. People can't speak. Those are brain diseases, too. We can enable and help those people first. But... And we're not the only things with brains on the planet, too.
Sure. I mean,
to the extreme, we might stop eating them and start collaborating with them, or at least, you know, it's sort of a joke around open water, but the biggest moneymaker of them all, I think people would pay anything to talk to their pets. anything.
Totally. That is your killer app. I've done a whole thing about ethics there. I know. I've done a whole thing about dogs and how dogs are treated here and everything else. But
yeah,
I talked to somebody who spent $100,000 to clone his two poodles.
Wow.
True. It's wild. But if people are willing to spend, I mean, obviously that's a unique case. People are cloning dogs, et cetera. People would pay a lot of money to be able to actually communicate truly with their pets.
Yeah. Does your dog love you or is it hungry? It's probably both.
Probably both, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really it's been it. Really fun to talk
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I want to thank Mary Lou for taking the time to sit down. I just find this area completely riveting. And even if a fraction of what she says comes true in the time she says it is, I mean, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Anyhow, I hope you guys enjoyed it. Like I said, I'll be back next week with not one, but two episodes before the Christmas break. And I'm also writing, as ever, in the Sunday Times this weekend. You can find me online at thetimes.co.uk, on Twitter at Danny Fortson, or you can email me at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That's all, folks. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.